that the Sarge hates, and he's watchful, keeping them in a tight group as they thread their way through the saloon car Sargasso. But they barely see a single hungry, all the way down the road, even though this area is all built up and ought to be crawling. And when they do get a sighting, mostly the deadbeats are a long way off, sprinting across the street north of them in pursuit of a stray cat, or just loitering at corners like streetwalkers from some apocalyptic nightmare. The kid, Melanie, is walking beside Gallagher for part of the way. She catches his gaze and then points, with her eyes up and right. When he looks, he sees another marvel. It's like a cross between a car and a house. Bright red, with two rows of windows and, he can see them very clearly, a flight of stairs inside it. But it's on wheels. The whole thing is on wheels. Insane. The two of them, Gallagher and the kid, go up and examine it together. This takes the kid further away from Helen Justineau than she's been at any time since they left Stevenage. But Justineau is looking at something else and talking with the Sarge and the doctor. They're free, for a moment, to follow their shared curiosity. The two-story car has crashed into the front of a shop. It's canted over on its side, just a little, and all of its windows are shattered. The perished tyres have fallen away in curved strips, like the grey-black rinds of some weird fruit. There's no blood, no bodies, nothing to indicate what happened to this awkward, towering chariot. It just reached the end of its journey here, probably a very long time ago, and it's stood here ever since. "It's called a bus," Melanie tells him. "Yeah, I knew that," Gallagher lies. He's heard the word, but he's never seen one. "Of course it's a bus. Anyone could ride on them, if they had a ticket, or a card. There was a card that you could put into a machine, and the machine would read it and let you on the bus. They'd stop and start all the time to let people get on and off. And there were special parts of the road that only buses could go on. They were a lot better for the environment than everyone driving their own cars." Gallagher nods slowly, like none of this is news to him. But the truth is, this vanished world is something he's profoundly ignorant of, and barely ever thinks about. A child of the breakdown, he was a lot less interested in tales of the glorious past than in how he could cadge a bit of someone else's bread ration. He uses artifacts of the past all the time, obviously. His gun and knife were made back then. So were the base's buildings, and the fence, and most of the furniture. The Humvee, the radio, the fridge in the rec room. Gallagher is a squatter in the ruins of Empire, but he doesn't interrogate the ruins any more than you'd interrogate the meat you eat to try to guess what animal it came from. Most of the time it's better not to know. In fact, the ancient relic that most excited his curiosity was a porno mag that Private Cy Brooks had under the mattress of his bunk. Leafing reverently through its pages for the standard price of 1.5 ciggies, Gallagher had wondered at whether the women of the pre-breakdown world really had bodies with those colours and those textures. None of the women he's ever seen look like that. He blushes to remember this now, with the little girl beside him, and he glances down to make sure that his thoughts haven't surfaced in some readable way across his face. Melanie is still looking at the bus, fascinated by its construction. Gallagher decides enough is enough. They should go back to the others. Almost unconsciously, he reaches out a hand to take hers. He freezes in the middle of the gesture. Melanie hasn't noticed, and she couldn't take his hand in any case, because her own are cuffed behind her back. But what a stupid, stupid thing to do. If the Sarge had seen. But the Sarge is still in deep and earnest conversation with Justineau and Dr. Caldwell, and hasn't seen a thing. Relieved, shaken, sheepish, Gallagher joins them. Then he sees what it is the other three are looking at, and these thoughts slip from his mind. It's a hungry, lying full length on the ground, in an alcove formed by the entrance of a shop. Sometimes they fall down and can't get up, when the rot inside them fucks up their nervous system to the point where it doesn't really work anymore. He's seen them sprawled on their sides, random shudders passing through them like jolts of electricity, their grey-on-grey eyes staring at the sun. Maybe that's what's happened to this one. But something else has happened to it too. Its chest has broken wide open, forced open from within by... Gallagher has no idea what that thing is. A white column, at least 6 feet high, flaring at the top into a sort of flat, round pillow thing with fluted edges, and with bulbous growths on its side like blisters. The texture of the column is rough and uneven, but the blisters are shiny. If you tilt your head when you look at them, they've got an oil-on-water sheen to them. Jesus Christ, Helen Justinu says, in a kind of a whisper. Fascinating, Dr. Caldwell murmurs. Absolutely fascinating.
If you say so, Doc, the Sarge says. But I'm thinking we should keep the hell away from it, right?
Fearless or foolhardy, Caldwell reaches out to touch one of the growths. Its surface indents a little under the pressure of her finger, but fills out quickly to its original shape once she draws her hand back. I don't think it's dangerous, she says. Not yet. When these fruits ripen, that may be a very different matter. Fruits, Justinu echoes. She says it in exactly the same tone that Gallagher would have used. Fruits, out of a dead man's rotten, broken-open body. Where would you have to go to get sicker than that? Melanie squeezes in beside Gallagher, peers around his leg at the fallen hungry. He feels bad for her, that she has to see this. It's not right for a little kid to be made to think about death. Even if she's, you know, dead. Kind of. Fruits, Caldwell repeats, firmly and with satisfaction. This, Sergeant, is the fruiting body of the hungry pathogen, and these pods are its sporangia. Each one is a spore factory, full of seeds.
They're its ball sacks, the Sarge translates.
Dr. Caldwell laughs delicately. She was looking really beaten up and exhausted the last time Gallagher glanced at her, but this has brought her to life. Yes, exactly. They're its ball sacks. Break open one of these pods, and you'll be having an intimate encounter with Ophiocordyceps.
Then let's not, Parks suggests, pulling her back as she goes to touch the thing again.
She looks up at him, surprised and seeming ready to argue the point, but the Sarge has already turned his attention to Justinu and Gallagher.
You heard the doc, he says, like it was her idea. This thing, and any more of them we see, they're off limits. You don't touch them, and you don't go near them. No exceptions.
I'd like to take some samples, Caldwell starts to say.
No exceptions, Parks repeats. Come on, people. We're wasting daylight. Let's move out.
Which they do. But the interlude has left them all in a weird mood. Melanie goes back to Justinu and walks right at her side, as though she was back on the leash again. Dr. Caldwell blathers on about life cycles and sexual reproduction until it almost sounds like she's coming onto the Sarge, who lengthens his stride to get away from her. And Gallagher can't keep from looking back, every now and again, at the ruined thing that's become so weirdly pregnant. They see a dozen more of these fallen, fruiting hungries in the next couple of hours, some of them a lot further gone than the first one. The tallest of the white columns tower way over their heads, anchored at the base by a froth of grey threads that spills over the hungries' bodies and almost hides them from sight. The central stems get thicker as they get taller, widening the gap in the hungry's ribs or throat or abdomen or wherever they first broke through. There's something kind of obscene about it, and Gallagher wishes to Christ they'd gone some other way, so they didn't have to know about this. He's a little freaked out too,
by what seems to be happening to the round growths on the fungal stems. They start out as just bumps or protuberances on the main vertical shaft. Then they get bigger and fill out into shiny, pearly white spheroids that hang like Christmas tree ornaments. Then they fall off. Beside the tallest and thickest stems, there are thin scatterings of them around which they step over with gingerly care. Gallagher is happy when the sun drops below the horizon, and he doesn't have to look at the bastard things any more. Chapter 48. The third night, for Helen Justineau, is the strangest of all. They spend it in the cells of a police station on the Whetstone High Road, after Sergeant Parks has ordered a short detour to explore it. He's hoping that the station will have an intact weapons locker. Their ammunition has been depleted by the skirmish in Stevenage, and every little helps. There's no weapons locker, intact or otherwise, but there's a board with keys hanging on it, and some of the keys turn out to be for the remand cells in the basement. Four cells, strung out in a row along a short corridor, with a guard room at the further end of it. The door that opens onto the stairwell is a 2-inch thickness of wood, with a steel panel riveted onto the inside. "Room at the inn," Parks says. Justineau thinks he's joking, but then she sees that he's not, and she's appalled. "Why would we lock ourselves in here?" she demands. "It's a trap. There's only one exit, and once we lock this door, we're blind. We wouldn't have any way of keeping track of what's going on above us." "All true," Parks admits. "But we know those junkers followed us from the base, and now we're getting into an area that had the densest population out of anywhere in the country. Wherever we stop, we're going to want to maintain some kind of a perimeter. Locked steel door is the most discreet perimeter I can think of. Our lights won't show, and any sound we make probably won't reach the surface. We stay safe, but we don't draw any attention to ourselves. Hard to imagine anything better on that score." There's no vote, but people start putting their packs down. Caldwell slumps against the wall, then slides down it into a squatting position. It might not even be that she agrees with Parks's argument. She's just too tired to walk any further. Private Gallagher is unpacking the last few cans of food from Wainwright House, and then he's opening them. It's carried on the nod, and there's no point in arguing. They close the door so they can put their torches on, but they don't lock it at first. Claustrophobia is already setting in for most of them, and turning the key seems too irrevocable a step. As they eat, the desultory conversation winds down into silence. Parks is probably right about their voices not carrying, but they still sound way too loud in this echoing vault. When they're done, they slip away one by one into the guard room to do whatever they need to do. No torches in there, so they've got something like privacy. Justineau realises that Melanie never needs to take a bathroom break. She vaguely remembers, somewhere in the briefing pack she was given when she arrived at the base, some notes by Caldwell on the digestive system of the Hungries. The fungus absorbs and uses everything they swallow. There's no need for excretion, because there's nothing to excrete. Parks locks the door at last. The key sticks in the lock, and he has to apply a lot of force to turn it. Justineau imagines, probably they all do, what would happen to them if the shank broke off in the lock. That's a bloody solid door. They split up to sleep. Caldwell and Gallagher take a cell each. Melanie goes with Justineau, and Park sleeps at the foot of the stairs with his rifle ready to hand. When the last torch clicks off, the darkness settles on them like a weight. Justineau lies awake, staring at it. It's like God never bothered. Chapter 49. Melanie thinks, when your dreams come true, your true has moved. You've already stopped being the person who had the dreams, so it feels more like a weird echo of something that already happened to you a long time ago. She's lying in a cell that's a bit like her cell back at the base. but she's sharing it with Miss Justineau. Miss Justineau's shoulder is touching her back, and she can feel it moving rhythmically with Miss Justineau's breath. On one level, that fills her with a happiness so complete that it's stupefying. But this isn't anywhere they can stay and live. It's just a stop on the journey, which is full of uncertainties. And some of the uncertainties are inside her, not out in the world. She is a hungry, with a driving need that will always come back no matter what she does. She has to be kept in chains, with a muzzle over her face, so she won't eat anybody. And they live together, forever after, in great peace and prosperity. That was how the story she wrote ended. But it's not how this real life story will end. Beacon won't take her, or else it will take her and break her down in pieces. Miss Justineau's happy ending isn't hers. She'll have to leave Miss J soon and go off into the world to seek her fortune. She'll be like Aeneas, running away from Troy after it fell and sailing the seas until he comes to Latium and founds the new Troy, which ends up being called Rome. But she seriously doubts now that the princes she once imagined fighting for her exist anywhere in this world, which is so beautiful, but so full of old and broken things. And she already misses Miss J, even though they're still together. She doesn't think she'll ever love anyone else quite this much. Chapter 50. The fourth day is the day of the miracle, which falls on Caroline Caldwell out of a clear sky. Except that it's not clear, really. Not anymore. The weather has turned. A thin rain is soaking through their clothes, there's no food left, and everyone is in a dismal, surly mood. Parks is worried about the E-blocker and taking it out on everybody. They're running low on the stuff and had to go sparingly when they anointed themselves before unlocking the door. And they've still got at least 3 days' journey ahead of them. If they don't manage to restock at some point, they'll be in dead trouble. They're still walking south, with the whole of North London and Central London and South London to get through. Even for the young private, Caldwell sees, some of the shock and awe has drained away. The only one who's still looking at every new thing they pass with indefatigable wonder is test subject number one. As for Caldwell, she's thinking about lots of things. Fungal mycelia growing in a substrate of mammalian body cells. The GABA-A receptor in the human brain, whose widespread and vital operation concerns the selective conduction of chloride ions across the plasma membranes of specific neurons. And the more immediate issue of why they're seeing so few hungries now, when yesterday morning they were seeing clusters of several hundred at a time. Caldwell hypothesizes a number of possible answers to this question. Deliberate clearance by uninfected humans, competition from an animal species, the spread of a disease through the hungry population, an unknown side effect of Ophiocordyceps itself, and so on. Obviously, the existence of the fallen, fruiting hungries is a factor. They've seen a lot more since they set out that morning, so many that new sightings arouse no comment, but it's unlikely that this is the sole explanation. For that, there would have to be hundreds of thousands of the things, not just dozens. To Caldwell's intense annoyance, she comes across no observational evidence that would help her to choose between the various scenarios she's theorised. Moreover, and this distresses her even more, she's finding it hard to concentrate. The pain from her damaged hands is now a persistent and agonising throbbing, as though she had an extra heart beating in each of her palms in very imperfect synchrony. The ache in her head tries to keep pace with both at once. Her legs feel so weak, so insubstantial, she can hardly believe they're carrying her weight. It's more like her body is a helium balloon, bobbing along above them. Helen Justineau says something to her, the rising inflection suggesting a question. Caldwell doesn't hear, but nods her head in order to prevent any further repetition. Perhaps Ophiocordyceps induces different behaviours in the mature stage than in its neotenuous asexual form. Migratory behaviours, or sessile ones. Morbid photosensitivity, or some parallel to the height-seeking reflex of infected ants. If she knew where the Hungries had gone, she could begin to construct a model of the mechanism that might lead her to an understanding of how the fungus-neuron interface ultimately functions. The day has a drifting, dreamlike feel. It seems to come to Caldwell from a great distance, only reporting in occasionally. They find a cluster of fallen Hungries who are fruited in the same way as the others, but in this case, they've lain down so close together that the trunks or stems that grow out of their chests are now joined together by rafts of mycelial threads. While the others stare at the fungal glade in sick fascination, Caldwell kneels and picks up one of the fallen sporangia. It looks and feels solid enough, but weighs very little. There's a pleasing smoothness to its integument. Nobody sees as she slips it, very carefully, into the pocket of her lab coat. The next time Sergeant Park glances around at her, she's fidgeting with her bandages again, and looks as though she's been doing it the whole time. They walk on endlessly. Time elongates, fractures, rewinds and replays in stuttering moments that, while they have no coherent internal logic, all seem drearily familiar and inevitable. The GABA-A receptor. The hyperpolarization of the nerve cell, occurring after the peak of its firing and determining the lag time before it's ready to reach action potential again. So precariously balanced a mechanism, and yet so much depends on it. Approach with caution, Sergeant Parks is saying now. Don't assume it's empty. In her lab at the base, Caldwell has a voltage clamp of the SEVCD variety, which can be used to measure very small changes in ion currents across the surface membranes of living nerve cells. She never trained herself to use it properly, but she knows that the cordyceps infected display both different levels of excitation from healthy subjects and different rates of change in electrical activity. Variation within the infected community is large, though, and unpredictable. Now she's wondering whether it correlates with another variable that she's failed to detect. A hand touches her shoulder. Not yet, Caroline, Helen Justinu says. They're still checking it out. Caldwell looks on down the road, sees what's standing there, 100 yards ahead of them. She's afraid at first that she might be hallucinating. She knows she's suffering from extreme fatigue and mild disorientation, arising either from the infection contracted when she injured her hands at the base, or, less likely, from the untreated water they've been drinking. Ignoring Justinu, she walks forward. In any case, the sergeant rounds the side of the thing now and gives the all clear. There's no reason to hang back. She raises her hand and touches the cool metal. In curlicues of raised chrome, from under its mantle of dust and filth, it speaks to her, speaks its name, which is Rosalind. Rosalind Franklin. Chapter 51. Caroline Caldwell was brought up to believe in the second law of thermodynamics. In a closed system, entropy must increase. No ifs, or ands, or buts. No time off for good behaviour, since time's arrow always points in the same direction. Through the gift shop to the exit, with no stamp on your hand, nothing that would let you come round and have another ride. It's 20 years now since Charlie and Rosie went off the grid. 20 years since they launched, without her, and lost their way in a disintegrating world. And now here's Rosie staring Caroline Caldwell in the eye, as demure as you please. Rosie is a refutation of entropy just by being here, so long as she's still Virgo intacta, not looted or torched. Door's locked, Sergeant Park says, and nobody's answering.
Look at the dust, Justinu offers. This thing hasn't moved in a long, long time.
Okay, I think we should take a look inside.
No, Caldwell yelps. Don't! Don't force the door! They all turn to look at her, surprised by her vehemence. Even test subject number one stares, her blue-grey eyes solemn and unblinking. It's a laboratory, Caldwell says. A mobile research facility. If we break the seals, we could compromise whatever's inside. Samples, experiments in progress, anything.
Sergeant Parks doesn't look impressed. You really think that's an issue right now, Doctor?
I don't know, Caldwell says, anguished. But I don't want to take the chance. Sergeant, this vehicle was sent here to research the pathogen, and it was crewed by some of the finest scientific minds in the world. There's no telling what they found or what they learned. If you smash your way in, you could do untold damage.
She physically interposes herself between Parks and the vehicle, but she doesn't need to. He's not making any move towards the door. Yeah, he says dourly. Well, I don't think it's going to be an issue. There's some serious plate on that thing. We're not getting in there any time soon. Maybe if we found a crowbar, but even then.
Caldwell thinks hard for a moment, sieving her memory. You don't need a crowbar, she says.
She shows him where the emergency external access crank is hidden, cradled in two brackets underneath Rosie's left flank, right beside the midsection door. Then, with the crank held awkwardly in her bandaged left hand, she goes down on her knees and gropes under the body of the vehicle, close to the forward wheel arch. She remembers, she thinks she remembers, the position of the socket into which the crank will fit, but it's not where she expects it to be. After a few minutes of blind rummaging, watched in bemused silence by the others, she finally locates the slot and is able to insert the end of the crank into it. There's an override control, but it was only meant to be engaged in conditions of actual siege. The vehicle's designers anticipated a range of situations in which it would be necessary to enter Rosie from the outside without compromising her interior spaces by blasting or forcing a way in.
How do you know about all this? Justinu asks her.
I was attached to the project, Caldwell reminds her tersely. She's lying by omission, but she doesn't blush. The pain of these memories runs much deeper than the embarrassment, and nothing would induce her to explain further. To reveal that she came out 27th on the list of possible crew members for Charlie and Rosie, trained for 5 months in the operation of the onboard systems, only to be told that she wouldn't, after all, be required. 26 other biologists and epidemiologists had placed higher up the list, had seemed, to the mission managers and overseers, to possess more desirable skills and more experience than those Caldwell had to offer. Since the completion of scientists for both labs was 12, that didn't even put her on the list of first alternatives. Charlie and Rosie sailed without her. Until now, she assumed that they'd gone down with all hands, lost in some inner city fastness, unable to advance or retreat, overwhelmed by hungries or ambushed by junker scavengers. That thought had consoled her a little. Not to think that those who'd beaten her had then died for their lèse majesté, but because her placing so low on the list had kept her alive. Of course, that's only a conceptual stone's throw from the thought that her survival is a side effect of mediocrity. Which is nonsense, and will be seen to be a nonsense when she finds the cure. The story of her failing to gain a berth on Charlie or Rosie will be an ironic footnote to history, like Einstein's alleged bad grades in high school maths exams. Only now, the footnote gains an added piquancy. They made this lab for her all along, and they didn't know it. They sent it here to intercept her journey. Parks and Gallagher are working the crank, which was too stiff and unyielding to move when Caldwell tried it. The door is sliding back, a half inch at a time. Stale air leaks out, making Caldwell's heart beat fast in her chest. The seal is good. Whatever happened here, whatever may have become of Rosie's crew, her interior environment appears to be sound. As soon as the gap is wide enough for her to get through, Caldwell steps forward. Right into Sergeant Parks, who refuses to stand out of her way. "I'm going in first," he tells her. "Sorry, Doc. I know you're keen to take a look at this thing, and you will. Just as soon as I check if anyone's home." Caldwell starts to state her reasons for believing that Rosie will be empty, but the sergeant isn't listening. He's already gone inside. Private Gallagher stands by the door and watches her warily, clearly afraid that she'll try to barge past him. But she doesn't. If she's right, there's no risk, but for the same reason, no real need for hurry. And if she's wrong, if the vehicle has been breached somehow, then the sergeant will certainly deal more effectively with anything that's inside than she could hope to do. Common sense dictates that she wait for him to complete his search. But she almost convulses with impatience. This gift is intended for her, and for no one else. There's nobody else who can use what's in there. What might be in there, she corrects herself. After so many years, there's no telling what could have happened to the precious equipment in Rosie's labs. After all, what conceivable disaster would have taken out the crew without harming anything around them? The most likely explanation for the sealed door and undamaged exterior is that one or more of the crew became infected while on board. She imagines them running amok through the lab in a feeding frenzy, toppling delicate imaging frames and centrifuges, trampling on petri dishes full of carefully incubated samples. Sergeant Parks emerges, shaking his head. Caldwell is so wrapped up in these disaster scenarios that she takes that for a verdict. She cries out and runs for the door, where Parks steadies her with a hand on her shoulder. "It's fine, Doc. All clear. Only body is in the driving seat, and he seems to have shot himself. But before we go in there, tell me something. Because this thing is way out of my experience. Is there anything in there I should know about? Anything that could be dangerous?"
"Nothing," Caldwell says. But then, the punctilious scientist, she amends that. "Nothing I'm aware of. Let me look around and I'll give you a definitive answer."
Park steps aside and she goes in, feeling herself trembling, trying to hide it. The lab has everything. Everything. At the far end, facing her, something she's only ever seen in photographs. But she knows what it is, and what it does, and how it does it. It's an Atlum, an automated lathe ultramicrotome. It's the Holy Grail. Chapter 52. Rosalind Franklin seems to thrill Dr. Caldwell and Sergeant Parks, no doubt for different reasons, but Helen Justineau's first impressions are negative. It's cold as hell, it echoes like a tomb, and it smells like embalming fluid. And she can see from Melanie's face that Melanie is even less enthusiastic. Of course, they've both got recent and unhappy memories of laboratories, especially laboratories with Caroline Caldwell in them. And that's what Rosie, as Caldwell calls this thing, really is. A lab on wheels. Only it's got sleeping berths and a kitchen, so it's a gigantic motorhome. And it's got flamethrowers and turret guns, so it's also a tank. There's something for everyone. In fact, it's almost big enough to cross time zones. The lab is amidships and takes up nearly half the available space. In front of it and behind it, there are weapon stations, where two gunners can stand back to back and look out to either side of the vehicle through slit windows, like the embrasures in a medieval castle. Each of these stations can be sealed off from the lab by a bulkhead door. Further aft, there's something like an engine room. Forward, there are crew quarters, with a dozen wall-mounted cot beds and two chemical toilets, the kitchen space, and then the cockpit,
which has a pedestal gun of the same calibre as the Humvees and about as many controls as a passenger jet. Justinu and Melanie stand in the forward weapons station and watch the activity around them, momentarily disconnected from it. Caldwell is checking equipment in the lab space. She's got a manifest in her hand. It was on the wall of the lab, closest to the door, and she's using it to find specific pieces of equipment, which she then checks for damage. Her expression is rapt, furiously intense. She seems completely oblivious of everyone else's presence. Parks and Gallagher have gone forward, past the crew quarters, into the cockpit. They're wrestling with something there, presumably the body Parks mentioned. After a while, they carry it through, wrapped in a blanket. It trails a complex raft of unpleasant smells, but they're mercifully old and faint. "Forward doors are locked," Park grunts. "Can't open them without power, it looks like. And the power's what we haven't got." They take it out through the midsection door, which is the one they came in through. Justinu notes that there's a complicated arrangement of steel armatures and plastic sheets on the inside of the door. She suspects that what she's looking at is a foldaway airlock. In a cupboard right next to it, she finds six sealed environment suits, the helmets huge and cylindrical with a narrow visor, like the heads of robots in a 1950s movie. The people who designed this thing really did think of everything. But apparently that didn't help the people who rode in it. Justinu puts a hand on Melanie's arm, and Melanie jumps almost a foot into the air. The extreme reaction makes Justinu start back in her turn.
"Sorry," she says. "It's all right," Melanie mutters, looking up at her.
The girl's blue eyes are wide and fathomless. Normally her emotions are all on the surface, but now, underneath the nerves and the general unhappiness, there are depths that Justinu doesn't know how to interpret.
"We probably won't stay here long," she reassures the girl.
But she hears the hollowness in the words. She doesn't know. When Parks and Gallagher come back, they talk with Dr. Caldwell in hushed, quick tones. Then Gallagher goes into the crew quarters, while Parks walks all the way through to the back of the vehicle. Curious, Justinu follows him to the engine room, where Parks is taking the inspection plate off what looks like a sizable electrical generator. He prods around inside it for a while, looking thoughtful. Then he starts opening the lockers on the walls, one at a time, and inspecting their contents. The first one has got about 1,000 tools in it, neatly mounted in racks. The next contains spools of wire, metal components wrapped in greased muslin, boxes of various sizes bearing long index numbers. The third has manuals, which Parks flicks through with frowning concentration.
"You thinking you can get this working again?" Justinu asks him.
"Maybe," Parks says. "It's not like I'm an expert, but I can probably makeshift. They've written these fix-it books for idiots. I can read idiot well enough."
"Might take a while."
"Probably. But Christ, this thing's got more firepower than most armies.
155mm field guns. Flamethrowers. It's got to be worth trying, right?"
Justinu turns, intending to tell Melanie that they might be staying here longer than expected, but Melanie is already there, standing right behind her.
"I need to talk to Sergeant Parks," she says.
Parks looks up from the manuals, his face impassive.
"We got something to talk about?" he demands.
"Yes," Melanie says. She turns to Justinu again. "In private."
It takes a moment for Justinu to realise that she's been dismissed.
"Okay," she says, trying to sound indifferent. "I'll go help Gallagher do whatever he's doing."
She leaves them to it. She can't imagine what Melanie might have to say to Parks that she doesn't want an audience for, and that uncertainty translates very readily into unease. Parks may have become relaxed about the leash, but Justinu knows he still sees Melanie essentially as a smart but dangerous animal, all the more dangerous for being smart. She needs to watch what she says around him, as much as what she does. She needs Justinu watching her back constantly.
Gallagher is doing more or less the same thing that Dr. Caldwell is doing, which is inventorying supplies. But he's doing it in the crew quarters, and he's already finished up when Justinu gets there. He shows her the last cupboard he opened. It contains a CD player and two racks of music CDs. Justinu feels memories prickle into stereophonic life as she scans the titles, which are, to say the least, an eclectic mix. Simon and Garfunkel, The Beatles, Pink Floyd, Frank Zappa, Fairport Convention, The Spinners, Fleetwood Mac, 10cc, Eurythmics, Madness, Queen, The Strokes, Snoop Dogg, The Spice Girls. "You ever hear any of this stuff?" Justinu asks Gallagher. "A little bit here and there," he tells her, wistfulness in his voice. The only sound system on the base was the one hooked up to the cell block that played wall-to-wall classical. One or two of the base personnel had digital music players and hand-operated chargers that worked by turning a wheel, but these priceless heirlooms were obsessively guarded by their owners. "You think there's any way we can play them?" Gallagher asks now. Justinu has no idea. If Parks gets the generator going, this thing will probably go live at the same time everything else does. It's been shielded from the weather in here, apart from the temperature changes. There certainly isn't any damp, which would have been the worst thing. If the fuse didn't blow and the circuit boards are sound, there's no reason why it wouldn't play. "Don't get your hopes up too high, Private, but you might get dinner and a show tonight." Gallagher looks suddenly cast down. "I don't think so," he says glumly. "How come?" He opens his empty hands in a wide shrug, indicating all the cupboards he's already opened and searched. "No dinner." Chapter 53. Parks calls a meeting in the crew quarters, but it only has four attendees. "Where's Melanie?" Justinu demands, instantly alarmed, instantly suspicious.
"She left," Park says.
And then, in the face of Justinu's ferocious scepticism, "She's coming back. She just had to go outside for a while." "She had to go outside?" Justinu repeats. "She doesn't get calls of nature, Parks. So if you're saying..." "She did not," Sergeant Park says, "go out for a bathroom break. I'll explain later if you insist, but she was actually pretty keen that I didn't tell you about it. So it's your call. In the meantime, we've got some other stuff we need to discuss, and we need to discuss it now." They're sitting on the edges of the ground floor bunks, precariously balanced. The sleeping berths are in vertical stacks of three, so the four of them have to lean forward to avoid bumping their heads on the middle cots, whose steel frames are at exactly the height best calculated to smack someone's brains out. There would have been more room in the lab, but apart from Caldwell, they all seem to prefer not to spend too much time in a place where the potpourri is formaldehyde. Parks indicates Caldwell with a nod. "From what the doc says, this thing we're sitting in was some kind of research station, designed to move around freely in inner-city areas and to be secure against attack from Hungries or anything else it came up against. Which was a great idea, and I'm not knocking it. Only, at some point, a couple of things happened. Can't be sure in what order. The generator blew, or something in the power feed blew. Maybe, since the generator mostly looks okay to my admittedly shit-ignorant eye."
"Maybe they ran out of fuel," Gallagher hazards.
"No, they didn't."
"The fuel is a high-octane naphtha kerosene mix, like jet fuel, and they've got about 700 gallons of it. And the tanks for the flamethrowers are full too. At a pinch, they would have been able to jury-rig something out of that. So, most likely it was a mechanical failure of some kind. Well, they should have been able to fix it because they got multiple spares for every damn part, but, well, for some reason, they didn't. Maybe they'd already taken some casualties, and the people they lost were the ones who were the best mechanics. Anyway, when we get that generator stripped down, we'll see what's what.
And we are definitely going to do that? Justin, who demands.
Unless you can think of a good reason not to.
This thing is built like a tank. It's everything the Humvee was, and a whole lot more.
If we can ride it all the way to Beacon, it could save us a world of heartache.
Justin, who can't help noticing that Dr. Caldwell's face is wearing a sly, smug little smirk. That makes her push against the idea, even though it's obvious good sense. We won't exactly be inconspicuous.
No, Parks agrees, we won't. People will hear us coming a mile off, and it'll be up to them to get the fuck out of our way, because once we start, we won't be stopping. Hungries, junkers, roadblocks, we just put our foot down and keep rolling. We won't even need to stick to the streets. We could drive right through a house and come out the other side. Only thing that will stop Big Fat Rosie is rivers, and they got maps in the equipment locker that show which bridges can take her weight. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't at least try. Worst that can happen is one of those bridges will be down and we have to drive a bit out of our way. Or she slips a tread or blows a gasket or something, and then we're no worse off than when we started. In the meantime, we get a respite from forced marching, which was taking its toll on all of us, and the dock most of all.
Thank you for your solicitude, Caldwell says.
I don't know what that is, but you're very welcome.
Two things, Justin says.
Sorry?
You said two things went wrong. The generator was one. What was the other?
Yeah, Park says. I was coming to that. They ran out of food. The cupboards are completely bare, as in, not one damn crumb. So, my disaster scenario goes like this. They lose the generator, and they can't fix it. They sit here for a few days or weeks waiting to be rescued, but the breakdown's still raging, and nobody comes. Finally, one of them says, screw this, and they pack their bags and hit the road. One of them stays back, presumably on guard duty. The rest walk off into the sunset. Maybe they make it somewhere. Maybe they don't. Most likely they don't, because the stay-behind kills himself and nobody comes back for the salvage. Which is our good fortune. He looks from face to face. Except that we run the risk of going the same way, he concludes. I don't know how long it will take to fix that generator, if we can fix it at all. But until we can do it, or until we give up, we're staying right here. So we need food, just like the original crew did. We used up the last of the tins we took from that house in Stevenage, and we didn't pass any place coming down here that hadn't been looted, torched, or flattened. Still got a fair amount of water, but we have to drink it sparingly because there's no place to stock up between here and the Thames. So we need to forage, and we need a quick score. Ideally, a supermarket that no grab-bagger teams or junkers ever found, or a house where the homeowners stocked up big time for the apocalypse and then got taken out early. Justin, who winces at that cold-hearted calculation. We'd be looking in the same place as the original crew looked, she points out. Parks turns to stare at her and she shrugs. I mean, it's safe to assume that they took a good look around before they abandoned this super-fortress and went out on the open road. If there was food that was lying there waiting to be found, they would have found it.
Can't argue with that, Park says. So the supply problem might be a serious one. Serious whether we move on or not, of course. But certainly more of a problem if we stay here for a day or 2 days or whatever while I mess with that generator. So it's a big decision. Maybe life or death. And it affects all of us equally. I'd be happy to make the call. But as you were keen to remind me a couple of days back, Miss Justineau, you're not under my command. No more is the doc. So I'm happy, just this once, to put it to a vote. Should we stay or should we go? Show of hands for trying to fix the generator and ride home in style. Caldwell's hand is up in a moment. Gallagher's slightly slower. Justineau is in a minority of one. Okay with that? Parks asks her.
I don't have much choice, do I? Justinu says. But the truth is, she was already on the fence. Her wariness about Rosie has a lot more to do with Melanie's visible tension and the events of the last day at the base than with any rational objection. She can certainly see the attraction of making the rest of the journey in the safety and comfort of a humongous tank. No more ambushes, no more exposure, no more starting at every sound or movement and looking over your shoulder every couple of seconds to see what's coming up behind you. On the other hand, Caldwell is still wearing her cat that's anticipating the cream expression. Justinu's mind and stomach rebel against the thought of being stuck in an enclosed space with the doctor for any longer than she has to. I'd like to be on scavenger duty, she tells Parks. I mean, assuming you don't need me to help with the generator. I'll go with Gallagher and look for food.
I had you both down for that, Parks agrees.
Can't start on the generator until I know what I'm doing, so right now I'm mainly reading through the manuals so I can identify all the bits and pieces I need. Still got 3 hours of daylight left.
So, if you're up for it,
I think the two of you should go ahead and use it. Keep in touch via the walkie-talkies. If you run into any trouble, I'll get to you as quick as I can. Dr. Caldwell, I'm letting you off that duty because your hands are still in a bad way, and you probably wouldn't be able to carry very much. Plus, we've only got the two packs.
Justinu is surprised that the sergeant bothered to justify himself. He's looking at Caldwell thoughtfully, like maybe there's something else on his mind.
Well, there are plenty of things I can do here, Caldwell says. I'll start with the water filtration system. In theory, Rosie was able to condense water from ambient air. Once the generator's working, we might be able to get that up and running again.
Good enough, Park says, and turns back to Justinu. You'd better hit the road if you want to be back before dark.
But she's not ready to head out just yet. She's worried about Melanie and she wants the truth. Can I speak to you? She asks Parks, conscious of the echo. In private.
Parks shrugs. Okay, if it's quick.
They go back into the engine room. She starts to speak, but Parks forestalls her by handing her his own walkie-talkie.
In case you and Gallagher get split up, he explains. Rosie's cockpit has a full comms rig, and is a lot more powerful than these portables, so you can take one each.
Justinu pockets the unit without even looking at it. She doesn't want to be derailed by a discussion of logistics. I'd like to know what Melanie said to you, she tells Parks, and where she's gone.
Parks scratches his head. Really? Even when she told me not to say?
She holds his gaze. You let her go out there on her own. I already know damn well that you don't see a risk to Melanie as worth taking into account, but I do. And I want to know why you thought it was okay to send her out there.
You're wrong, Park says.
Am I? About what?
About me.
He plants his butt against the opened cowling of the generator, folds his arms.
Okay, not that wrong. A couple of days ago I said we should cut the kid loose. She's pulled our irons out of the fire twice since then, and on top of that she's turned into a really good scout. I'd be sorry to lose her.
Justinu opens her mouth to speak, but Parks isn't finished. Also, since she can lead people back to us, letting her wander around on her own out there is not a decision that comes without consequences. But after what she told me, it seems like the least worst option. Justinu's mouth has gone a little drier than it already was.
What did she tell you? She demands.
She said our E-blocker isn't worth fuck anymore, Helen. We put it on way too thin this morning, because we've only got half a tube left between the four of us. I thought this rig would have some, but it doesn't. It's got the blue goop that Dr. Caldwell uses in the lab, but that's just a disinfectant. It's not going to kill scent in the same way.
So the kid's been smelling us all day, and she's been going half crazy with the hunger all the time. She was scared shitless she was going to get loose and bite one of us. You, particularly. And that was why she didn't want me to tell you any of this. She doesn't want you to think of her like that,
as a dangerous animal. She wants you to think of her as a kid in your class.
Justin, who feels dizzy all of a sudden. She leans back against the cold metal of the wall, waits for her head to stop spinning.
That, she says, that is how I think of her.
Which is what I told her. But it didn't make her any less hungry. So I cut her loose.
You
took her outside, took off the cuffs and off she went. Got them right here, ready for when she comes back.
He opens one of the lockers and there they are, laid down all neat and tidy next to the coiled leash.
I showed her how to take the muzzle off for herself, like she didn't figure that out already. It's just a couple of leather straps. She's going to stay out until she finds something to eat. Something big. The plan is for her to gorge herself to bursting, not come back until her belly's full. Maybe that will keep the feeding reflex at bay for a while.
Justin, who thinks back to the way Melanie was behaving before she left, the violence starts and the general unease. She gets it now, understands what she must have been suffering. What she doesn't get is Parks changing his mind about the muzzle and the cuffs. She's both bewildered and a little resentful. It seems, in some way, to threaten the bond she's developed with Melanie, to have the other members of the party, especially Parks, extending the same trust to her.
You weren't worried she'd bite you? She asks him.
She hears the snide insinuation in her own voice, and it suddenly sickens her.
I mean, you think we can keep her with us, even if she's hungry?
Well, no, Park says, deadpan. That's why I let her leave.
Or do you mean was I afraid when I took the cuffs off?
No, because I kept my gun on her.
The kids, unusual.
Uniques, maybe a better word.
But she is what she is. What makes her unique is that she knows it. She doesn't cut herself any slack. A lot of people could take an example from that.
He hands her his pack, which he's emptied.
You mean me? Justin, who demands. You think I'm not pulling my weight?
It would feel good to have a stand-up argument with Parks right then, but he doesn't seem keen to play.
No, I didn't mean you. I meant in general.
People in general? You were being philosophical.
I was being a grumpy bastard. It's what I wear to the office most days. I guess you probably noticed that.
She hesitates, wrong-footed.
She didn't think Parks was capable of self-deprecation. But then she didn't think he was capable of changing his mind. Any more rules of engagement? She asks him, still hurting in some obscure way, still not mollified. How to survive when shopping? Top tips for modern urban living?
Parks gives the question more consideration than she was expecting.
Use up the last of that e-blocker, he suggests, and don't die.
Chapter 54. Gallagher wishes he was on his own. It's not that he doesn't like Helen Justineau. If anything, it's the opposite. He likes her a lot. He thinks she's really beautiful. She's had star or co-star billing in a number of his sexual fantasies, mostly playing the role of the highly experienced and wildly perverted older woman, picking up a boy young enough to be her son and showing him the ropes. A lot of times the ropes weren't even metaphorical. But that makes it all the more awkward to be out on a patrol with her. He's scared of saying or doing something really stupid in front of her. He's scared of being in a position where he has to make a quick decision and not being able to think of one because he's thinking too much about her. He's scared of not being able to hide how scared he is. It doesn't help that they can't even talk to each other. Okay, they exchange a terse murmur every now and then when they've come to the end of a street and they have to decide where to go next. But the rest of the time they walk along in complete silence, in the slow-mo shuffle that Sergeant Parks has taught them. It sort of feels like overkill right then. In the first hour after they leave the armoured truck with the stupid name, they only see four live hungries, and none of them close up.
Then they find the first dead one. It's fruited like all of those others, except that it's fallen down on its stomach and the big white stem has punched